Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. Welcome back, that is, back to the Sundance Film Festival coverage. And welcome back also to Eric Hines. Hello, Eric. And I'm going to do the newscaster thing again. I don't know why, maybe in a past life, wanted to be a TV news person. How does it look on the ground?
On the ground is basically, I feel like I'm physically on the ground at this point. It's day seven for me in person here at the Sundance Film Festival. It is my last in-person day. And it is, it's a grind. It's a grind. It's going and, working in the minds of a film festival. You know, nothing worse, nothing more taxing to a human being than getting to go to movies and a few parties and to not eat a vegetable for a week. But, here I am. I'm very, very happy to be talking to you, and hope you're all enjoying my low, bassy morning voice here on day seven. So
No, it's good. It's like you got a real late night quiet storm DJ voice. So I think that'll be good. Well, let's dive right into it before you expire. not in imminent danger, just so people know. And I thought we could talk about maybe one or two dramas, maybe especially one really anticipated one. And then there's plenty of other good stuff as well. Cat Person was a, very anticipated film, has a couple of recognized actors in it and, has this pedigree of a New Yorker story that, well, people have already read as much from previews, but I thought it would be interesting if we actually talked about it briefly, having seen it.
Yeah.
So.
it's wildly bad. I just sort of was watching it, shaking my head the whole time. There's just nothing about it that clicks for me. And it also, it's one of my least favorite movie tropes that somehow I guess it has to look cool on the page, but when you actually put onto screen the trope of the character imagining something that doesn't happen.
Yes.
And then you have to cut to prove that no, that was actually the imagination. But we're gonna get a little bit more savvy about that over the course of the film. So you're not gonna know if it's in the imagination or if it's real. I find it the dumbest trope. And obviously there's this thought that this is perfect for cinema. Cinema can do this, but other forms can't. Let's do it. And it's just, to me, it's just so exhausting and childish. And this film kind of does it, from the very beginning.
No, it's funny you point that out because it's something I've noticed in other movies at the festival as well. I think a similar thing happens in Eileen. Uh-huh. It also happens in Sometimes I Think About Dying. And then at a sort of key moment, and maybe more than one moment, it happens in Magazine Dreams. And I'm pretty sure I'm forgetting one other movie. Oh, and that's just this year.
Yeah.
And yeah, I agree. It probably is something that sounds like, oh, this is quintessentially cinematic that we can actually show, what a person's fantasizing or dreading instead of like all the really cool, actually really cool things literature can do. But it's not even like a medium thing. It's just how kind of glib and sort of in a way like manipulative it can feel is in the texture. But I just wanted to sketch for people who have mercifully like avoided the actual story of this. I just want to describe it's basically I will confess here, I never actually read that story because I thought I've had too many New Yorkers piling up like everyone. I'd be damned if I'm gonna read the viral story. I'm going to read the one that is someone who actually needs, some attention or something.
There's no skipping in the queue, Cat Person. Get in line.
That's Cat Person. Don't be such a cat person. So yeah, it's basically...
Interestingly though, you're a cat person, Nick, so it's a bit surprising.
Maybe subconsciously, that's why I had a certain... what do they say? My hackles, my fur was raised, got my back up. But it's a story. Emilia Jones plays a college student. She works at a movie theater. It is sort of inexplicably a movie theater that's showing like stuff that Joe Dante would be into in a college campus today, like monster creature flicks and stuff.
And it's only like the beginning of what world does this film take place in?
Yeah.
Like there's that and everything. Please proceed. Anyway, she works in a movie theater. Yeah. We're going to wind up talking about this for an hour and a half, but go ahead.
No, I mean, exactly. Yeah. But yeah. And Nicholas Braun plays the guy who comes in to see a movie, you know, strikes up a conversation and, you know, eventually asks her out. So it's the just kind of excruciating progress of their dating, which is initially cute, or I don't even know if you call it dating, and then disastrous, and then like cataclysmic. And, you know, at some point, you know, a lot or most people might just be pulling the ripcord before the end. But if you make it to the end, it's something. It's something.
But here, we're on here to maybe to point out that maybe we're not recommending anybody even start the film, let alone make it to the end. Just because we did doesn't mean anyone has to watch this beyond this festival ever again.
That it's probably going to be unavoidable because it's a movie that's also tailor-made to create expectation, to have pieces written about it as the story was already. And that's, you know, I'm sure how something like this gets made. And I mean, what is the ideal world description of this movie? That it's a, you know, snapshot of of, I don't know, the trials and travails of dating in social media age, and whatever toxic oblivious guy, and
yeah,
and well, there's also the age mismatch, yep, that goes on, and yep. I mean, my part of my ideal would be like that we're getting into an interior monologue of her view on it. Part of it is those kind of like fantasies or the dream sequences or whatever you call them, dread sequences. Yeah, all of it just rang so hollow. And I guess what I kept saying to myself is like, this is one of those movies where the deck is so stacked,
yeah,
that like I'm just not like buying any of it on like a human level.
Well, here's the thing. That's exactly it. The story, I think, went viral because it, from perspectives, various perspectives, it kind of had a finger on the pulse of some sort of this particular moment of dating and social media and sexting and all that stuff. And, you know, as right, the sort of like the supposed toxicity about age difference and all these things are in the story. When you see them depicted on the screen like this, it can't feel like it's, you know, got the finger on the pulse of anything, because there's no pulse. There's also no recognizable reality to the one that we live in. And so how can you possibly, I mean, there's just, to me, that's the biggest flaw of it. Like it seems to be made by people who have never touched a phone, let alone said a text, you know, who have never been on a date, let alone been on a date in 2022. The world that it's set in doesn't seem like ours. And listen, these are very, very appealing people too, you know, like sort, yeah, of the daughter in Coda, a film that happened last year, whether or not anybody remembers it. And, you know, cousin Greg from Succession, who like everybody absolutely adores and wants to see in moving pictures. And yet, you know, there's just nothing there.
And I mean, it's weird because if I keep talking about it, I'll eventually say, well, you know, I mean,
I'm hearing it,
you know. And it's just natural because I think it comes out of like concern for the character as a human being. Like, I'm sorry you're in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, for the Emilia Jones character. Because I have to say the Braun character is just kind of, it's not necessarily a non-starter, but after a certain point is a non-starter and becomes like a mouthpiece.
Yep.
And then unfortunately the Emilia Jones character does as well. And she has a friend. And look, I love like, you know, combative, too close for comfort, you know, but fundamentally loving like friendships in movies, you know, and this sort of has that until it also turns into like the friend is just representing something.
Right.
Just representing like a overly protective vision of, you know, feminism and awareness of the world as it is. The ending, like I can't even, I guess I'll just leave it at that.
See, already you're more, you know, of the moment and of the sure, world we live in.
Yeah. And I guess here's where we put the disclaimer that we're both ancient
people. Yes.
So
are the buyers of the film, and this will not be really making its way to movie theaters. I'm convinced.
Really? Oh, I think,
I
you think it's going to go to a streamer instead, you mean, or?
I think maybe a streamer will be able to do something with it. I also just feel like, I don't know. I think the smell is going to precede this one, but we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, I could see it being maybe a little of that, but then possibly being repackaged where the ending leads it in some way, you know, leads the framing of the movie.
It could be. I just also feel like it's going to be another 6 months to a year by the time somebody actually puts this into theaters, and at that point, is anybody caring about Cat Person anymore? Like, it's just whatever that viral sensation was is further and further in the past. And if that's really all we're going on, that's not a lot. This is me. This is Biz Talk with Eric Hines.
The Biz Talk. That's right. That's our Biz Chat. Thanks for the industry buzz. Well, okay, we've already talked more, so now we have to compensate.
We have to actually spend some time on films we like.
Well, let's go to the film that you love.
So I guess that would be Fremont, which, you know, so I finally caught up to a little bit later. It was recommended to me early. It is a black and white independent American film. It is about this young woman named Danya. She is Afghan, living in the town of Fremont, California, which is outside San Francisco, as part of a community of folks who relocated in light of the Afghan war. She was a translator for the U.S. government and has been sort of separated from her family. That's all backstory. Basically, she is somebody who works in a fortune cookie factory and lives alone and can't sleep. And that's sort of the premise of the film. And part of what I liked about it so much is there's all that backstory around it, but it is not really overladen with those things. You know, she's just sort of a not particularly dynamic, to say the least, young woman who has a friend, an older woman in the factory, and because she can't sleep, but also doesn't have any kind of money or health insurance, winds up, you know, getting a pro bono therapy in order to get sleeping pills, and also ultimately in order to sort of work through some of the things that she's kind of silently holding, and then develops into a bit of a muted, melancholic, emerging love story towards the end, as far as I will say. But there's just something about the quality of this film, in terms of its tone, its pacing. I think it's really funny a lot of the time without really sort of overselling itself as a comedy. There's something very deadpan and old school about the way this is told, and certainly the way that it looks too. It's that decision to go with, you know, as you might, maybe 80s, 90s American indie black and white approach. I actually don't even know if I'm doing it enough service, because its qualities are a little bit harder to pin down, and it may not be for everyone. But I was just sort of utterly taken by it. Another thing I really like about it is that all the characters in the film, the supporting characters, tend to be substantial enough to have enough moments that they have seemingly souls and inner lives of their own. And it's also about almost entirely people who are nice. There's one character who's not very generous, and everyone else is nice or tries to be nice. They may be a little bit creepy. They may be a little bit inappropriate in terms of time and place, but they're trying. And I appreciated that without it being, it's not rosy whatsoever, but it at least populates itself with people that you actually might care about. What did you think, Nick?
Yeah, I felt the same way. I mean, I think it's a hard balance to get this particular type of deadpan. Like, it's like a, it's almost like a particular kind of like piano piece or something, you know, that takes a lot of skill to pull off. And then hopefully you just ignore the skill that's involved.
Right.
I was interested that it is a sort of recognizable kind of deadpan comedy, you know, person feeling on the margins and working their way, but it has its own personality. The writing is fresh enough, and, you know, her friend, especially this kind of like slightly overconfident analyzer of her life, of her friend's life, you know, which is just makes, is just sweet and which feels real, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also just the, you know, as you mentioned, the backstory of the main character that, you know, it's actually made me think back. Obviously, comparison always is telling me to a Jarmusch, something from the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I actually specifically thought like Stranger Than Paradise, you know, the woman that the two numbskulls befriend is like a emigre, is a Hungarian emigre, the actress as well. And it's great. That movie is absolutely like a masterpiece. But it's just interesting to have someone who is like grappling with being in America, and but with a very different kind of backstory. This is a Muslim movie where you can peel, and there are like some layers, like there's layers of trauma in here, but they don't also take over the movie. I mean, they're there. So yeah, there's a lot to appreciate, you know, and just remember that Greg Turkington is in this.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, he's maybe the part where he's hilarious, but he's maybe the part where it teeters into the kind of deadpan comedy that you wouldn't love.
Yeah.
But it is a very funny bit that's going on there.
I know, it is a funny bit. And I think that it worked for me because he's put opposite this character who's so well established. And her and her deadpan is so well established that, you know, and also, you know, this is the thing, like, even though he's doing a great bit, and it is like, in a sense, Greg Turkington, as straight as you're going to get him, right? Because it's not a winking performance, but he's also kind of lovely, you know? Yeah. At the same time, you know, yeah, he might be the easiest person to laugh at, but he also is trying.
Yeah.
And that's a huge difference, I think, in terms of Stranger Than Paradise, which of course indeed is its own thing and does not need to be brought in. And this film doesn't need to be overladen with it. But, you know, the way that Stranger Than Paradise is very cool. You know, it is like legendarily cool. This is actually like very, very earnest, but in a way that I never find cloying, you know? So it is probably a more welcoming space.
Yeah, for sure. And there are these sort of interesting, like, awkward points of tension she has with other people who are in the same situation as her. And there you just sort of get a glimpse of that community of, you know, immigrants that is also functioning there for her. So it's interesting to see her act different ways in different contexts, as opposed to just, again, being like this stock deadpan protagonist.
Yeah. And I think there's a really great design to how it does that, where you keep encountering characters in almost identical shots. You know, there's the monotony of the day to day, and okay, this is where she eats, and this is when she's up all night. This is the guy who's smoking out on the balcony. You know, but those, they develop. You know, like, the longer you encounter these people, the more things emerge about them and about their interaction, which is just a really nice way of designing, of plotting character and revealing of backstory.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to think about that movie again. I saw it kind of in a flood of MOOP titles early on, and it was a very welcome, just like, oasis.
you know,
especially like compared to another movie. Oh, this is what I was going to say. Sometimes I think about Dying, which is sort of working with a similar template of a very reserved female protagonist who finds connection, but only after kind of feeling quite removed from the world, but to an exaggerated degree where, especially with like an actor like Daisy Ridley, I just like, why are you doing this to her? You know, it's like, I didn't, you know, whereas here I was very happy to see the actress who is, I want to say she's a non-professional. Am I right? I think so.
I don't know enough about. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that she, the backstory is fictional, but she also is an Afghan refugee, the actress. But in terms of whether or not she has any acting experience, that I don't know.
I guess there's always something I love when you just are able to hear even a little of the whole size of people's lives that you don't know about, you know?
Yeah.
Again, another kind of dimension to her character. And again, she's a translator originally, I guess.
Well, it's just, you know, I feel like this is so many immigrants.
Yeah.
I mean, not to state the obvious, but I actually do feel like it is vastly underexplored in American cinema and storytelling when people come to America in particular and have interesting, varied lives, well, you know, education, careers, and then come and, you know, work in a factory like this. You know, and I feel like this is extremely common. It's kind of nice to see that play out. And that, again, that's not the point of it. You know, there's a lovely relationship, but between two people who are also lonely, who consider each other best friends, where they come from, they would never be friends. They would never even meet each other. That's, again, that's not what's sort of emphasized, but it's embedded, you know, it's inside that interaction. Yeah. It's just, it's nice to see.
Yeah, definitely. So that is Fremont, director Babak Jalali.
Yes. Who I don't think I've seen his previous films. Frontier Blues, Radio Dreams, Land are the three previous films.
And then there's also
a narrative film that you really loved.
Sure, yeah. I think on another episode, I said that A Still Small Voice was like one of my two favorite movies in the festival so far. And the other one is completely different, and that film is Rotting in the Sun. Charming title. But just such a overly dramatic title. That's also why part of what I love about it. Just, you can imagine someone just spitting it out, like saying, there's actually a reason why it is the title film, but I won't give that away. But this is a film directed by Sebastian Silva, who also stars in it. And he's a director that is a really, really sharp and funny and original voice, and especially like satirical voice.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe there's still like the Michael Cera collaborations still kind of are what people think of, and That's When He Lost Me or something like that.
Well, I mean, I'm going to quickly sort of address that, because he is probably one of the most loyally programmed by Sundance. I mean, pretty much everything goes to Sundance from Sebastian Silva. Yeah. And I actually don't know that that's been best for him, because there's something about even me, like I've seen these films over the years, and I have complicated feelings about them. Some I like, some I don't like at all. But there's just something a little bit like, okay, another Sebastian Silva film. I think in some ways they probably need a different showcase, or they need a different, curatorial push, which is not a knock against Sundance programmers who clearly really like his work. But I don't know that people are, there's something about it that seems like another 3 years go by and there's another one of these. But he's also gone in this direction, so I really want to hear what you're saying about it, in this direction of putting himself in the films. And there's a real sort of docu-fiction quality there that he's been running on, which is not where things began when you look at like The Maid, which is sort of like a somewhat of a big deal about 12 years ago. And then Magic and Crystal Fairy, the Sarah films, as you're saying, you know, the two films that were programmed the same year at Sundance that year. And then Nasty Baby and Tyrell. And it seemed like people were running out of interest in his work. And, but deserved or not. So I'm just, in some ways, I wasn't necessarily paying too close attention to Riding in the Sun, because I was just worried that it was more of the same. So tell me about Riding in the Sun.
I'll tell you all about Riding in the Sun. that's really a good point to remember about his being, kind of a Sundance fixture, but at the same time, maybe by being sometimes like the turd in the punch bowl kind of person in terms of what his films are doing compared to a lot of films, that maybe it doesn't serve his films as well as it could. His films just sort of will rub people the wrong way because they are sarcastic and skeptical of pieties,
right?
Basically, and sometimes like borderline the un-PC kind of way.
Yeah.
But I think he gets pretty far. He does something with that. And Tyrell, I'm not aware of like what happened to it after it got released, if it lasted longer than a week or two, but that was a movie that was really interesting to watch. So anyway, I think Rotting in the Sun, maybe you might have different mileage of this one, because he turns a lot of his sarcasm and humor on himself, because he portrays himself as a filmmaker, as just this kind of guy who's just about to like quit filmmaking, is doing drugs all the time, is fed up with everyone. A lot of people are fed up with him. He's maybe thinking of trying painting instead. His house cleaner is played by the actress who plays the maid in Maid. Mm-hmm. And she ends up having like a new role in this movie as it proceeds. But he basically like trashes himself in this movie in the beginning in very funny ways. He's just this pathetic figure. Like in the first minute, he is taking his like dog out for a walk, and he's trying to have like some profound experience reading this book that's about like why not to live anymore. It's called The Trouble with Being Born, which is like this work of philosophy. And he like turns and he sees like his dog eating shit. It's just like, it just takes the air out of everything about being like the too cool, sarcastic voice in the room. And so he's struggling to even get the, energy to do something new. And the target, that he has that is not himself in this movie is like Instagram culture, influencer culture. And I have to say, like, having seen various like parodies of that, as a lot of people have, I'm sure, this is like the one that I can more than stand found like really funny. And he gets this influencer, Jordan Firstman, he's just very kind of like brash, just like wonderfully loud and shameless character, who's pushing him into doing a movie with him or doing some sort of project together. And Silva's basically like, what you do is crap. Like, I don't want to do any of this. Eventually they do, but it doesn't quite get off the ground because I'm trying to figure out whether to like reveal the next plot step or not. And I probably not, but it just can't. It can't for very strong reasons. So that's one aspect. Another aspect is just this Sebastian Silva character's experience of like the basic like gay scene around him, yeah. Which through his eyes in this movie is just like this relentless procession of just hooking up around him. And he just can't, he's like, he literally says like, I'm just going to read my book. And I've just found that pretty funny as well. And he's managed to sustain all this with this really like deft, like handheld approach to the camera work. The comic timing is incredible. Hmm. I should have looked up who he edited with. So yeah, for all of that. And then I won't spoil the ending, but the end it is the best ending I've seen at the festival. Past lives. But anyway, and all like the class stuff that ends up being there, especially in the second half of the film. You know, there's cynicism about people being completely wrapped up in themselves, but with a real smart and sharp edge to it. Okay. So yeah, that's the movie.
All right.
And I don't know, maybe some of these targets are going to be like way too familiar for some people or what. But yeah, I also think he's like a great comic performer. Like I don't,
right.
He has this amazing kind of like beleaguered, short-tempered presence in it, which is great and feels genuine as a character. It just, you know, it surprised me. I don't know, you know, surprised me in some intelligent way. That's like sometimes that's goes a long way.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So yeah, Rotting in the Sun. I thought maybe we could squeeze in one more movie. Maybe I think both of us saw The Tuba Thieves.
Yeah, The Tuba Thieves. It's yet another film in the next section. The next section this year seems really sort of packed with films that could easily be in other sections that probably ought to be in competition sections. Mm. It's a little bit mystifying. You know, Fremont was in next as well. But Tuba Thieves is basically undescribable, but I'll do my best. You know, it is a film called The Tuba Thieves, which is inspired by a real-life 2011 rash of tuba thievery, where tubas were being stolen from school band rooms. This film really doesn't get into that at all. I mean, there's an element there of that school and some folks who work at that school being cast in the film. And there's referencing of that. And there's title cards that, you know, intertitles, I should say, that sort of update us on thefts. But the substance of the film you're really looking at is pretty non-narrative and experiential, and has, you know, a lot to do with sound, and it's basically non-narrative, and it's sort of, it's glimpses of things, and it's often glimpses of things so that you can reckon with sound, you know, the cast of people, and there are people cast in parts. It's, you know, very much a hybrid in this way that there's kind of scripted and sort of dramatized interactions between people in the deaf community. Those are our characters, but they're also characters who intersect with sound in some way. You know, we have a character early who's in an office doing a hearing test and a speech test. And so though he is a deaf character, like we're reckoning with him in sound as another character who's his partner, who is a drummer, you know, and we don't even really see her traditionally drumming. We see her interact with the kit, and her father works in an ice rink and drives a Zamboni, and there's all these incredible sounds associated with it, but you're constantly aware that he's not experiencing these sounds the way that you might be. And it also, you know, there's a descriptive text, you know, permanently on this film. It is not an option, you know, so there's subtitles and descriptive text. So there's layering throughout in terms of the layers of sound and image, but there's also the layer of text and different types of text, strict translation versus what's, I think, a more creative endeavor of descriptive text. And there's a lot of really great description here of the things you're seeing and hearing. I would imagine that if a Sundance audience is going in to encounter this film without any notion that this might be a largely experimental work, it might be frustrating, but I just found it an entirely unique space to enter into and to be thinking about images and sound as much as I'm experiencing images and sound. And there's also, it's very California. It's very Los Angeles. You know, it feels like just a very, very different community than we normally see on screen, with a different way of looking at the environment of California. You know, it even takes moments to show wildlife throughout the area and what they may be experiencing in terms of sound, in terms of the volume of jet engines flying over while, you know, animals sort of go about their lives, and whether or not they even take notice of the ear splitting sound. So it's not remotely an essay film, but it has kind of like the depth and thickness of an essay film, because each of what it's showing and what it gets into, it's kind of interrogating and wanting us to sort of like reckon with it alongside.
Yeah. While you were talking, I was trying to figure out how to express what it is about this film. And I kept coming up just with that it has this positive life force to it. There's just something about the film as it moves between all these different, you know, all these different arenas, you know, I mean, the kind of foundation is I guess the relationship between a couple, but beyond that, yeah, it's just going through all of our different ways of communing with sound and music, and from a particularly affirming, but it sounds so bland. One other thing is that a lot of it is live music. So there's a lot of either like recreations of or made to look archival things that aren't even always explained who they are, but there's just a constant energy coursing through each of them. And the overlapping of communities is really interesting. You know, the way this movie shows sometimes the friction or sometimes the coexistence between, like, I think there's like at one point, like a sort of hardcore band playing.
Yeah.
And I think it's in the same room, or it's being hosted by like a community like deaf center, I believe. And then another point, I think there's almost like a recreation of like a John Cage piece being played or something.
Or
so you see people's reactions to that, and the camera work especially has a way of just moving you through these spaces where you're, you know, it's like a Wings of Desire-y kind of like honing into people's like sensory and spiritual and spaces, and then going along to someone else a little bit. That's not a lot of it. That's just some of it. The camera is just, you feel like it's making all the right moves. And it's strange also that the movie can be so disparate in all of its elements and fragmentary. It's fair to call it like a sort of fragmentary film, but it feels all of a piece. It just has this tone running through it somehow. And yeah, it's punctuated by these captions about tuba thefts from schools, which it's so strange because it's like a hook, and at like a couple points you get like glimpses of recreations of that, but that's not in the film at all. And it's just such a funny like little piece of like experimental like sleight of hand or something that I kind of love. You know, it activated something in my mind of like some sort of weird dynamism, but also what's taken away. And I got really angry about that at points, but then I get back into the wash of people's sound experience. You know, it's just a very intriguing way to activate all of this. It's, I don't know, wondrous kind of film.
Yeah, agreed.
The director again is Allison O'Daniel. And I don't know, have you seen or heard work by her, other work?
Well, she comes from more of an experimental background, but I think similar in terms of approachability, you know. She had short work that was at True False a few years ago that was in this terrain. But yeah, that's sort of where she's been coming from.
Yeah, and this is kind of a bridge kind of work. I mean, if, like you're saying, it's like experimental in form, but I feel like it's something that people can sort of step into and sit with.
Well, not to go down an avenue that probably can't really be supported and is a discussion in itself, but I do feel like sometimes experimental work can be necessarily, in terms of what its intentions are, as much about itself and its own form as about, you know, a sense of communication or a bridge of some sort. And this film seems very much preoccupied with, you know, this may not be a narrative film, but it is looking to communicate, you know, and it is also looking to communicate the kind of various sort of imperfections of communication, you know, and there's something about that that's built into it, which is even when it feels obtuse and you don't quite know why you're looking at this thing after the last thing, it very much wants you to be there engaging with it.
Yeah, definitely. And while at the same time having a lot of those dialogues, I think, with other films and formal things going on, you know, I do hope people are able to see this after the festival as well. I guess that's the fun thing. I guess now for this festival, I can say like buy it or rent it or whatever online. I think it's available online. I could double check that.
I think it is. And that said, I mean, in fact, that we both had an experience together with it shows that it works regardless. But there is something very, very special about seeing this film in a theater with, you know, sound was really cranked up, and you were even issued balloons so that
Could
feel vibration. Yeah, so that not everybody had them, but Allison sort of spoke about this afterwards. Like this, she'd been experiencing that like decades ago. This is actually something that often is done in spaces where deaf or sort of hearing impaired folks are there, because you can, it's very sensitive membrane of the balloon allows you to feel subtleties of vibrations and subtleties of having sound affect that object. And so it sort of brings into like a physical space of the theater that opportunity of being surrounded by sound and having there being a physical manifestation of it. So yeah, there's something really quite nice about this film in a physical space.
Wow. Yeah. Well, forget what I said. Wait for it in the theater. Because I wouldn't, especially if they're balloons.
Yeah,
I love that. Yeah. So yeah, the Tube of Thieves. Well, I think that might bring us in for a landing with the good vibes of the Tube of Thieves. Any last parting words?
No, just that I think I'm not alone in leaving the festival at this time. I think this being the first time back physically, not everybody is staying till the bitter end, as you know, I actually usually do. I don't know how long they're going to be doing the hybrid festival like this. I have thoughts about whether or not they should, but I think that there is an advantage here of I'm leaving tonight and I still plan on spending the weekend watching films, and you know, you listening can as well. And that's a good thing. And there's even, I think Sunday is like, if you're purchasing things online, you can buy like a last day, the award winner pass or something like that, that allows you to basically view all the films that win awards this weekend. I don't know. I think that's kind of an exciting thing. You know, one of my favorite things in staying to the bitter end is they do that in person here, that the entirety of the theaters are taken over by films that just won an award the night before. To be able to do that at home over the weekend and have people sort of share in that aspect would be kind of cool. So anyway, I'm just saying I look forward to still continue watching over the next few days. And I know that you plan to as well.
Yes, yes, indeed. I've already been trying to game out how many I can see without completely dissociating. occupational danger.
Yes.
Well, thank you for bringing it to us live from the slopes of Park
City.
Very
alive. You can feel the energy vibrating through your ears right now.
I suppose now I should reveal I've been holding a balloon this entire time. All right. Well, we'll wrap it up there. Safe travels back.
Thanks,
and happy, continued viewing.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.